The Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome, everyone. We have a fairly short agenda today. We're going to start because it's Dairy Day at the Capitol. We thought we would hear from some of the dairy producer industry in relationship to the programs that we oversee in this committee. There's a lot of connection here. So we'll start with that, and then we're going to hear from the Met Council about our Metro Parks program. So we've got Pat Luneman and Bob Lefebvre. How's that? My children speak French, so I should have them pronounce it better. I don't know what the Minnesota pronunciation is. Welcome to the committee. Who wants to go first?
Madam Chair, I'll go first. Members of the committee, we thank all of you for inviting us here today. I am president of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association and also a dairy farmer from Todd County, Minnesota.
Can you just introduce yourself for our records, please?
Okay. Patrick Luneman from Clarissa, Minnesota, Minnesota Milk Producers president. Minnesota Milk Producers is a grassroots producer organization that has 1,600 members of all different types and sizes across Minnesota. We have organic producers, we have the traditional producers, and the new modern style with the larger dairy farm producers. So we represent all types across the board in Minnesota. Dairy farmers over the years have put in a significant amount of work in our state, you know, helping settle the state, and have invested many generations of work on our farms. As we drive across the state, you can see that. And most of those farms are family farms. You know, I have 6 children, and they all get a chance to learn what work is, and yes, they go to school and do things that they're supposed to do as children. But, you know, we're raising the children there where we breathe the air and drink the water, and we're concerned about how our farms are, just like everyone else in the state is. Unfortunately, when our forefathers settled these farms, many times they settled the farm right next to a creek or a pond or a lake, because they needed to water the cows. They needed to have access to water all times of the year. So now, after we've invested generations of work into these farms, sometimes some of us find ourselves in a dilemma where we're not environmentally friendly because we should be making changes or move the dairy farm to a different spot that's better for our environment.
Well, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Mr. Luneman. Senator Kubley has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think, you know, farms were located next to streams because that was the advice that farmers were getting from the people that best knew at that particular time. And so, you know, I mean, I don't want you to say that, you know, that they just did this because they needed water. They also did it because they were getting the best advice available to them, and that's where it was recommended.
Thank you, Senator. Now, in order for us to be in compliance, and I want you to know that we're in favor of having clean air and water, too, we cannot do this alone. Farmers, if they have to fully fund the changes, many of our producers will not be able to make that conversion to meet the 2010 deadline and all of the rules that we have. They may have to make a choice whether they remain in business or not. And to shut down their business in light of the times that we have, I don't know that there's a good place for those farmers in the workforce right now. And is it in the best interest of our state to not have them adding to our economy. So at Minnesota Milk Producers, we believe it's in the public interest for the state to provide cost share to help keep our dairy farms viable, contributing to our economy, our food supply, and all the while becoming environmentally friendly, sustainable, and in terms that all of us can be proud of. We can have a clean environment that all of us can be proud of, but we are going to need your help. And yes, we will work ourselves and contribute out of our pockets to work towards that goal as well. But we can't do it alone. By working together, we can all have a positive outcome. And Madam Chair, at this time, I would like to pass the microphone to Bob Lefebvre, our executive director.
And I, Mr. Luneman, I have some questions. I want you to explain more about the 2010 deadline and what it's requiring, but I don't know, do you want to go through the presentations first? Maybe you'll get to some of that.
That might be best,
sure.
Madam.
Sure, let's do that. Welcome. Mr. LaFave.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Bob LaFave, and I have the opportunity of serving Minnesota dairy farmers as our executive director of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. I gave you a little brief overview, and again, I want to be a bit more specific on some of the critical issues of importance to this committee. First, briefly on Minnesota's overall environmental regulations, and specifically the permitting and environmental review process. As you know, Minnesota has high environmental standards for livestock producers. For those over 1,000 animal units, or 700 cows, the standards require zero discharge from the farm site. In addition, operations must follow a closely monitored nutrient management plan detailing how much manure is applied and when and where it is applied, including setbacks and amount limitations. For those under 1,000 animal units, the standards include limiting discharges to a near zero on the farm site through what's called the MinFarm model. Farmers, when expanding or building a new livestock facility, regardless of size, must meet their respective regulations before being permitted to build and operate. MPCA and or our counties do a good job of managing this confusing and extremely time-consuming process. Unfortunately, the current system is riddled with challenges that many times are outside the control of MPCA and the county. These challenges oftentimes lead to duplication of regulations. I want to make it very clear that we're not asking for a lowering of environmental standards or environmental regulation, environmental standards. We do ask for improvements in the system that eliminate excess government spending and redundancies in oversight. These improvements should not only be made to save the state resources, but it's also important to have concise and efficient processes in place that preserve our natural resources while providing rural landowners and government officials at all levels with a clear and consistent process. The second component of the environmental regulations pertains to those farmers who are not expanding or building totally new facilities. For farmers in this category, we use the term compliance with Minnesota's feedlot regulations. The good news is that according to a recent feedlot financial needs assessment report by Bowser, basically all dairy farms, over 300 animal units are in full compliance with the state feedlot regulations. For reference sake, a 300 animal unit dairy is equivalent to someone milking about 150 cows, and plus they have all their young stock on that farm. That's trying to give you that reference. But since our regulators deal in animal units, we have to be able to make that conversion. The unfortunate piece is that there's still over 1,000 dairies under 300 animal units that are in need of environmental upgrades in order to comply with the feedlot rules by October 2010. Again, that's according to a recent Bowser report. The state, in the past, provided approximately $1.5 million annually for feedlot water quality grants. And these grants, these are grants that specifically went to dairy producers under 300 animal units to help them comply with the feedlot regulations. A couple of years ago, these resources were removed from base funding. You did, however, appropriate one-time funding for feedlot cost share assistance to producers located in impaired watersheds, and we thank you for that. Since that time, there has been no base funding for feedlot water quality grants, and Minnesota Milk respectfully asks for clean water funding to help dairy producers comply with the feedlot regulations and thereby improve the quality of our collective natural resources. We believe funding from the Clean Water Constitutional Amendment should be considered. First, cost share to producers improves water quality by reducing manure runoff from their open lots. Second, the outcomes are measurable. Third, the enhancements benefit every Minnesotan. Governor Pawlenty's budget recommendation for Bowser does include a sufficient, although modest, amount that could be allocated for new water quality grants for feedlots. And we ask that the legislature support clean water funding for Bowser's feedlot cost share program. Before I close, I'd like to turn it over to Tim Giesecke with Ag Resource Strategies to give you a brief overview on what we've been doing as dairy farmers to be proactive in addressing natural resource concerns. What we bring to the table is a process to increase efficiencies for regulators and conservation assistance providers, and to keep our non-farm neighbor and to help our non-farm neighbors gain a better understanding of livestock farmers' natural resource stewardship practices.
Great, thank you, Mr. Lefebvre. Welcome, and can you spell your last name? I didn't quite catch it.
Sure, it's Giesecke, G-I-E-S-E-K-E. And as Bob mentioned, I'm here with my business, Ag Resource Strategies, and I was hired to manage the Livestock Environmental Quality Assurance Program. And that program continues through June of 09 and thereafter, but the pilot program ends in June of 09. I will be following the outline I handed out here and describe some of the components of the pilot program and then how we envision this to be a progressive piece in meeting some of these environmental issues that dairy farmers and cattle raisers face. The LEQA program was developed by industry with cooperation of state governments and nonprofit organizations and conservation groups. And there were three main objectives on there. One was to conduct 100 farm assessments. And that will by no means clean up the state waters, but the pilot project was to identify how this process works and how to move forward on it. And so of the 100, we've accomplished 73 so far. We'll meet our 100 goal by June of 09. There's several registering this year again. But what we've learned is the assessment piece has been critical in that since the 1980s, federal, state, and local governments have lost the capacity to conduct whole farm resource assessments. Due to program changes and evolution of that process, that's been eliminated. And so the LEQA program brings that assessment piece, that whole farm assessment, back to the farm operation. That is key for the farmer to understand what their needs are, but also key for the state cost share programs to also know what the farm needs are, and they can target cost share dollars. The analogy I often use is that of a home inspector. A home inspector comes in and checks your foundation, your roof, all those components. They necessarily don't fix it, but they understand where they're at so the homeowner can talk to a contractor or whatever means. That piece is vitally needed back into the conservation delivery system. And we have done that fairly efficiently with agriculture, private sector, as well as local government units. Also, there's a five-star rating that has developed, that's been developed for certain standards in soil, water, odor and air, habitat, and community image. That was developed with these standards with the Minnesota Milk Cattlemen and the state governments. What's so critical about having a five-star rating, or whatever you want to call it, is that it provides the livestock operator with an endpoint. So the LEQA program is probably the starting point in the assessment and an endpoint. Those two components, again, are missing from the programs of the state and federal governments. And it's probably in industry's best interest and the government's best interest to have ownership with the farm groups. So the LEQA has brought forward these two starting and ending points is critical. The third objective, which I found to be one of the most challenging, my background is with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and is to integrate a private sector program into the government delivery system. As Pat said, industry can't do this alone. We need the help of cost shares and things like that. At the same token, the state governments and local governments can't do it alone, as they need this assessment on the ground piece. So what we've accomplished is an assessment, an action plan, and an implementation track that a farmer can enter. And so they know what their needs are, and they can bring this assessment sheet to a local government unit, and it's kind of like that home inspection sheet. Here are the things I need. Do you have any programs for it? It makes the Soil and Water Conservation District's activities much more efficient because they don't have to visit the farm. They don't have the time to go out to all the farms. And so that piece has been put in place. And what we see going forward on this to perhaps address the 2010 rule, and I think most people are aware that there isn't enough time and money to fix all these lots by 2010. But if we look at this LEQA program as an assessment, planning, and implementation track to those open lot goals. So not that the producer should just wait until cost share comes, but to jump on this track to get an assessment done, perhaps refine the Bowser feedlot assessment piece, because that was an excellent piece, but on the groundwork is even more precise. And then the value for this has to be for the producer as well as for the government agencies. And on this LEQA program, I believe we can raise the level of compliance assurance. And if the farmer reaches a 5-star rating, it should be good enough for the local governments to trust to a certain level. It should be good enough for Bowser to trust. And so we need to build in a little more rigorous assurance piece on this. And when we move into TMDL issues and they are requiring reasonable assurance, can we use this tool to provide reasonable assurance where it's necessary and more definite assurance where it's necessary? And so to use this tool to help the state and local governments meet their goals as well. The other piece that I'll just touch on briefly, I work in the farm policy area. There's a lot of integration that can occur with this LEQA program up with the Farm Bill programs, and that we'll. I just want to mention that we're not doing this in a vacuum of just state issues, that federal issues are also a key component. On the backside, I broke down the resources concerns that have been identified by water, air, soil, habitat, and community image. These are things that have been identified on the 73 operations. The next column is which ones have been addressed to date. But this kind of gives an example of getting these producers on a track, start the implementation, and then ultimately have a 5-star assurance that they can provide to the agencies that provide funding or regulatory controls on this.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Yep. Giesecke. So you're doing this, the assessments, is this paid for by some government funding? Or
It was a pilot program to go from, I believe, August of 07 through June of 09. Mm-hmm. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture had Clean Water Legacy Funds to put money forward, and that ends when this pilot is over.
Okay, and this committee doesn't oversee the ag budget, that's Senator Vickerman, so some of us aren't as familiar with those details.
Sure.
Okay, you said that you're going through this list of criteria and identify different things for farmers to look at. What, I don't see anything here that, do you specifically test the quality of the water after you put all these different measures into place? I mean, how do you measure the improvements to water quality?
Sure. The USDA has their technical Bible, Field Office Technical Guide, which has been built over 70 years, and those practices are recommended to provide improvements to there. So in the assessment piece, you can determine erosion rates under certain tillage practices. By changing those tillage practices, you have an outcome, an identifiable outcome, a buffer strip of 30 feet provides more, than a buffer of 15 feet. So the practices that are installed are using that as a measurement. It's cost prohibitive and impossible to measure non-point source pollution. There is many surrogates out there to do that at the university level and at the USDA level, but to measure water quality at each farm is technically and physically cost prohibitive. So what we do is use the practices in the technical guide and also their university and USDA surrogates of water sampling of how those improve it. So that is the process of that. So a 30-foot buffer is designed to do a certain sediment reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then so that is credited toward that water quality goal.
Okay, but we don't you said it's impossible to measure non-point source.
Yes, by definition.
By definition.
Yes, because a point source you can measure. Non-point source is diffuse.
Right.
And so you can't measure it.
I mean, you could measure it right at the farm and see if you can see a difference in how much soil, you know, what the amount of sediment is right there. But, of course, there may be other factors contributing. That's
yes, and we yeah, there is monitoring that goes on, but it is more of a surrogate monitoring. I mean, you can't measure each farm, so many testing has been done by the university, and we use that data.
But, I mean, we just need to be sure that what we're funding is actually effective in improving
yes.
water quality. And so what you're saying is we're really relying on university models to determine which practices are going to reduce sediment and phosphorus, et cetera, going into the water?
The USDA Conservation Field Office Technical Guide and what Bowser relies on for applying cost share dollars to their practices, mm-hmm. we use the same system as the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the USDA.
Mm-hmm. And Madam Chair?
Yes, Mr. McCabe.
Thank you. We also do measure, because of mm-hmm. The Min Farm model for, if you will, the farm site itself is the closest thing that we have to a point source within agriculture. Mm-hmm. And that is measured. I mean, we do know very well, actually, for a CAFO or anyone over 1,000 animal units, it's zero discharge. There is no discharge that comes from that farm site. And for those under 1,000 animal units, it's near zero. It's that Min Farm model that is an acceptable level for the state of Minnesota. So we do measure that discharge there and the result.
Okay. So so you said that pretty much all the large dairies are compliant and we're in good shape there. It's the small ones that we're concerned about. Is that what one of you said? That all of them over 300 animal units are in full compliance? You wrote that down. Somebody said that.
Yes, Madam Chair. According to the Bowser Financial Feeds assessment, virtually all dairies over 300 animal units mm-hmm. are in full compliance with the feedlot rules by, yes, already at this point.
Ahead of 2010 and with zero discharge.
Right.
And
well, for those over, Madam Chair, for those over 1,000 animal units, mm-hmm. They're again at a higher level.
At a higher level than the 300.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolute zero discharge, and they have a nutrient management plan that's closely monitored, which is more than those under 1,000 animal units, which is what the state mm-hmm. Regulates.
But for the smaller, there's over 1,000 that aren't ready. That was the issue that you brought up. So, and the cost share. So tell us a little bit more about that. What kind of, what kind of improvements, the assessments that you've done, Mr. Giesecke, are they on the smaller dairies or what size?
They range with all the dairies from the organic to the larger operations. It's a voluntary program, mm-hmm. and so whoever wants to assess their operation and meet a 5-star standard is allowed to enter the program.
Okay. Well, for the smaller under 300 animal units, what kind of level of investment is needed for the most part to be able to come into compliance with the law?
Madam Chair, we'd have to go back to some of the best numbers, again, is what Bowser has in her financial needs assessment. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency also did a survey with county feedlot officers. The numbers vary a little bit, but at minimum 10 years at $4 million of state cost share per year. And John Jasky, the executive director with Bowser, may be better informed.
Yeah,
I don't have
him.
That off the top of my head. But I believe that's about the number. In total, I think that's just for dairy, too, Madam Chair. We know that cattle producers, for example, we have a little over 1,000, according to that Bowser report, that are under 1,000 or under 300 animal units that are not in compliance. We know that there's, according to that same report, over 3,000 cattle operations in that same boat. Hmm. I think the number over in total was staggering $150 million. Again, maybe I shouldn't, in order to have everything come into compliance,
And that's what percent would the state be paying to get to that number? All right, we can ask Mr. Jasky to answer that if you don't have that up.
75%. John Jasky, Executive Director. I don't have all the numbers. We can certainly get you that report and review that at some point in the future, but the state standard for the cost share is up to 75% is paid for under the state cost share program. I should also mention that very often we combine the state's funding with federal USDA funding under their EQIP or EQIP program, where they pay 50% and the state would pay the 25% and then the producer would pay the additional 25%.
So that $4 million a year for 10 years or something like that, you said, is that your...
Madam Chair, that's in the ballpark, but I don't have that committed to memory. I need to refresh my memory with the report in front of me.
And so that would be assuming about a 75% government contribution to the cleanup.
Madam Chair, that is correct, that a 75% was the number we presumed as a ratio throughout.
And the law says now that if we don't provide 75%, they don't have to comply?
What it currently prescribes is that if cost share is not available beyond, there's a couple of caps, $3,000 for operations under 500 animal units and $10,000 for operations, I think, under 1,000 animal units, that if no cost share is available, the liability for the producer is capped at those amounts.
And how much is in the governor's budget for this?
Madam Chair, you know? Members, I believe it in the combined fiscal year 10 and 11 was $4.5 million.
Okay. And that was from Clean Water Legacy or from constitutional dedicated funds?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
On the Constitution Amendment, I know there's money in there for clean water. Agriculture. I wasn't able to be here the other day when Rommel held her meeting. But I want to be sure that ag comes into this constitutional amendment, water legacy. We have to be part of that if you want us to clean up things. If you picked a paper up today, dairy farmers are in a precarious position. In fact, a lot of them I don't think are going to make it. I met with Colin Peterson, and he said it's going to be a real shakeout in the dairy industry for too long. California milk was $24 a hundred. Today it's $9. But the feed cost didn't go down. All the regulations didn't go down. So if you go to buy milk in a grocery store, that didn't go down either. So we kind of have to look at that whole, and I dairy, so I know how hard that is. So... Ag's not going to be out alone. Ag wants to work with your water quality because it's all part. We're all part of that family. So I just want to be sure that there's some money, that agriculture at least gets some of it to help, and I know how difficult it is. But
Well, the voters spoke and said we're willing to spend money to protect the water, and that includes water next to every farm. You know, that's part of the water bodies in Minnesota. So that it certainly fits within the constitutional amendment. I think our main job is to figure out how much, well, to make sure that money is really well spent and that we're getting the water quality. It's going
to
clean up the water. We got to know it's actually working. And that's my main concern, is to make sure that the money is spent well, and that maybe there's some things that people have been doing that are more effective than others. And how do we know that? I guess that's what I'm trying to grapple with. How do we know what really is effective? Because it's a lot of money we're talking about. Senator Chaudhry.
Madam Chair, maybe Mr. Jasky has some thoughts on this program and some of the outcomes that have come out of it. We had a very good hearing the other day on Reinvest in Minnesota, and this is kind of it's not exactly the same, but it's kind of a targeted rim for farms, this LEQA program. And I'm just curious, since Bowser has been involved with it, have you been able to measure some outcomes of the of the not the places where you've implemented this program?
Madam Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I'm not as prepared as I probably should have been to come here today. I was thinking that the dairy folks were going to do most of the talking, but...
And Madam Chair, Mr. Jack, I wasn't looking for specific data. I mean, you drilled down in the details the other day on RIM, but just generalities would be helpful, and then maybe we can explore the details later.
Well, as Senator Anderson indicated, I mean, and as Mr. Giesek and others have said, we rely on these empirical models and based on research to pick the most cost-effective and water quality benefits that you're going to expect to see on a project. MinFarm is this model you apply on a site-specific basis to determine whether you need this practice or that practice as the most effective way to control the potential runoff from that site. The question was asked whether we have actual water quality data, you know, kind of on a farm level, and there's very, very little of that. But one idea that's been talked about is something that has been done in Wisconsin where they have many dairies, smaller ones, many of them are, where they, it's called discovery farms, where they try and, on a very limited basis, but with good selection, you can get some field level measurements to actually determine, you know, the water quality improvements from, you know, upstream and then downstream of that particular operation. I think that's some of the things that we'd like to try and do more of here to calibrate those models with real world experiences and practices.
Yeah, that would be really a good use of our dollars to make sure that, you know, all the future expenditures are used wisely. Do you have a proposal to do some of that testing or to do that kind of a pilot in Minnesota?
Madam Chair and members, I've been talking with Department of Agriculture a little bit about that because they've gone over there and actually looked at some of those sites. So the University of Minnesota and MDA and us have talked about how to package that. We know we can't put a lot of money towards it because, you know, we have to get the projects on the ground, too, and we're always struggling between finding out new information and actually getting solutions on the ground. But we will have something in more detail for you at a later date.
And, again, I think the voters that passed this constitutional amendment, they want to see results. You know, they're willing to spend more money as long as we get our water clean. And I don't think that's too much to ask. I think that we owe it to the people of our state to that, you know, we should be able to make that happen.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lefebvre.
And to that point of a discovery farm type of concept, I think the beauty of that, as soon as we're able to collect some data and adjust the models, and this program, this LEQA program that Tim talked about, is able to immediately make those changes within the assessment structure to account for whatever we may find within the discovery farm concept. So really, they go hand in glove, the type of programs. So I think get to your point.
Yeah, I think that makes really good sense. This is a good way of starting, you know, that evaluation process and making sure there's kind of standardized ways of measuring how you're doing and the improvements that have to be made. Great. Are there other questions, Senator Torres-Ray?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also would like to hear, I don't know if today is the time, but I'm not very familiar with some of the programs that exist in this area. And part of what I struggle with is understanding, you know, how much money do we have to invest in cleaning versus sustaining projects that are more looking at the future of having farms that are cleaner. I would like to hear more about, you know, how is that the state could invest more money and resources in projects that are looking at clean farms and looking at very futuristic and innovative practices so that we just don't have to clean and really do something different, farming that is more sustainable, and so that we don't have to, because we're not going to have enough money to do the cleaning. So how do we work on prevention, I think is what I'm asking for.
The prevention.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Torres-Ray, we would definitely love to have that discussion. We see many innovative things happening on dairy farms today, capturing methane gas, generating electricity, or capturing that gas, cleaning that gas so it's natural gas, it's pipeline grade, hydrogen fuel cells on dairies as a result of dairy farms and dairy cows, and on the types of things that are happening out there. Not only clean farms, if you will, but also those types of farming operations that are a part of the green solution, if you will. We certainly would love that opportunity. Thank you for that question.
Madam Chair, just one thing I would ask that this committee, a lot of you don't serve on agriculture. I'm going to have to make a special effort to see that we don't cut the ag department down too much because of food safety. We got the best lab in the country, bar none. And so we looked at the peanut butter, peppers, milk. Let's be sure we don't shortchange that for the good of all of Minnesota.
Yeah, that's one of those basic kind of things that government needs to deliver for people, is making sure the food supply is safe. And we saw what happened when we relied on these private labs without any regulation over them. Boy, I think that's what's caused the whole peanut problem. You know, there's no oversight.
I like peanut butter, but I was
Me
at
too.
I was at a convention, and all the ag people, when I missed that day, they gave us a whole bunch of peanuts from Georgia. I just throw them in a basket.
I know. It's really a shame. It's really a shame. It's really going to hurt that industry. You know, and I didn't order any Girl Scout peanut butter cookies this year, and I hate to do that to the Girl Scouts, but, you know, we're all nervous, and so it's...
Slim mints.
Thin mints. I can live with, you know, buckets of thin mints.
Oh, Madam Chair, I'm...
Senator Kubley.
I'm not sure I remember the exact temperature, but I think you'd be safe in consuming something that's been baked.
Uh-huh. You're probably right. Probably true. But I don't know if the cream in the middle is baked. Okay. Well, this has been really interesting, and it's good to have you here to get a little bit of more information than we usually have delved into in this committee on the dairy industry. We really appreciate your being here, and please stay in touch with our committee as we move forward in our budget discussions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Greg, do you want to say that number, by the way? That's the one thing we forgot to say on the record. Oh, I'm going to ask Mr. Knopf also, there's the report that I think it was referenced about the total cost that we could be looking at for the cost share.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I did borrow a computer back here to look it up online. That Bowser report is online. And I think the discrepancy in the numbers is when we're talking $400 million, that's the total amount needed for these feedlots to upgrade, those under 300 animal units. But it includes some other things that aren't part of the cost share program. And the cost share estimate for the 75% of what's eligible was about $180 million for the same farms. A big part of that, there's $160 million that's estimated for equipment needs of those farms for manure handling and spreading equipment, which is not, of course, cost share eligible. It would be eligible for low interest loans, but not cost share. And that's why the number $180 million for the cost share component, but it's $400 million total for those farms to upgrade, including the equipment and the other non-cost share types of items. So that's, I just wanted to make sure it was clear on how those numbers were evolved or gotten to.
Thank you. All right, thanks very much. Now we're going to turn to the Metropolitan Council presentation on Metro Parks. We weren't able to have the State Parks presentation yet today because we're going to do that along with some other DNR budget on Thursday. We'll be getting to the rest of the parks budget. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Bell and Mr. Steffarud.
Yes.
Looks like, is that Como Parks Frog Pond?
Madam Chair, it's a pleasure to be here with you and the committee this afternoon to go over the regional park system in the 7-county metropolitan area, and perhaps more importantly to touch on what the governor's recommendations are for the state's contribution to the operating costs of the regional park system. Madam Chair, I could go through my entire presentation and then entertain questions, or I'd be happy to entertain questions throughout the presentation, whichever is your pleasure.
Why don't you try to do your presentation, and if we feel really compelled to interrupt, we will, but we'll try to wait. And thank you for the beautiful photo of Cuomo's frog pond.
Yes. Madam Chair, a bit of history on the regional park system. The 1974 Metropolitan Parks Act established the Metropolitan Regional Park System. The Parks Act directs the Metropolitan Council to identify land for regional parks and trails that is to be owned by cities, counties, and the special parks districts, which together with state parks and trails will meet the outdoor recreational needs of the residents in the Twin Cities 7-county metropolitan area. The law also directs the council to grant state and regional capital funds to regional park agencies to acquire land and to develop parks and trails in our regional parks policy plan. Madam Chair, there are essentially two sources of funds for the capital side of the regional park system from the state. One is in our Environmental Natural Resources Trust Fund, which there is an allocation of between $1.5 million and $2 million per year that the council matches with on a 40-60 basis. And the council also does a match for bonding every 2 years. The state bonds between $7 and $10.5 million. That's what's happened over the last a couple of sessions. And the council also bonds on a 40-60 basis. Those two funds together are the state's contribution to the capital needs of the regional park system. I might add quite quickly that the regional park system has 53,000 acres of parkland, 177 miles of trails. And Madam Chair, in our park system plan, we propose to increase the amount of acreage in our regional park system from 53,000 acres of parkland to about 70,000 acres of parkland, 177 miles of trails to over 800 miles of trails. And the funds and the sources of funds, which I just illustrated, is how we intend to or hope to pay for the expansion of our regional park system. I would also add very quickly, if you do the math, we only propose to increase our regional park system commensurate with population growth. So we are 2.7 million in the 7-county metropolitan area, actually over that now, about 2.9 million. We anticipate that we'll be about 3.7 million by 2030, about a 30% growth, not quite. And we are proposing to grow our park system acreage commensurate with the increase of population in the 7-county area. Next slide, please. We do the planning for the regional park system, fund much of but not all of the capital needs of the regional park system, and the operating and a small sliver of the operating budget of the regional park system. We do not operate the regional parks. That is in comparison to, for instance, our transit system, where we do all of the planning for our transit system, Madam Chair, and then, of course, we operate it as well. We do the planning for the regional park system, fund some of the operating costs, but do not actually operate the regional parks. They are operated by 10 implementing agencies, the counties of Anoka, Ramsey, Washington, Dakota, Scott, and Carver all have entities that run their park system, in addition to the Minneapolis Parks and Recreation Board and the cities of St. Paul and Bloomington and the Three Rivers Park District, which really oversees regional parks and trails in the suburban portions of Hennepin County. Those 10 entities that I just mentioned actually operate the parks.
Mr. Bell, maybe I will interrupt for a moment just to remind please. Committee members that are not from the metropolitan area. I'm sure you've heard this said before, but unlike the state park system, these systems are not only operated by these local units of government, but the vast majority of the funding comes from local city or county taxpayers pay for the bulk of the funding.
That's correct, Madam Chair. That's
systems.
Particularly true for the operating side of the equation.
Yes.
And as you're aware, Madam Chair, in statute, it states that the state should pay at least 40% of the operating costs of our regional park system. And to date, we have not come close to, have not been able to come close to that number. There are 37 parks within those 10 implementing agencies. There are 12 park reserves within those 10 implementing agencies and 6 special recreational features as well. And as I indicated, over 170 miles of trails, and that's something that in our parks system plan we propose to grow significantly. As you can see, Madam Chair, this is the growth of usage in our regional park system, ranging from 5 million visitors in 1974 to 33 million visitors in 2007. I might add, Madam Chair, that we at the Met Council do an annual survey of the citizens in the 7-county metropolitan area. And for as long as I've been chair of the council, which is for 6 years, the past 6 years, the residents in the 7-county area list the park system as the number one amenity in the 7-county in the 7-county region. I always say it is one of our few truly bipartisan activities. Liberals, moderates, conservatives, Democrats, independents, Republicans, all use and I think appreciate what the parks have to offer. Next slide, please. I will go into the funding question, Madam Chair, that we were just speaking about a minute ago. On this slide, what you have is the state's contribution to the implementing agencies, those 10 implementing agencies, their operating budgets. And as you can see in fiscal year 08, there are essentially two sources of funding for 08, 09, 10, and 11 for the state's portion. In fiscal year 08, it was 4.57 from lottery proceeds went to parks operations, and $4.05 came from the council. In fiscal year 09, it was 4.57 and from the lottery proceeds, and again, 4.05. Given the budget challenges that the state faces, the $4.8 billion shortfall, the administration is proposing a modest, what I would characterize as a modest reduction in the state's portion. Lottery proceeds would be maintained at $4.57 million, but the state's portion would go from 4.05 to 3.6, and that would be the same, Madam Chair, in fiscal year 11 as well. This would be a net reduction of 4.64% from the state's current contribution to park dollars. You can see this pie chart perhaps is a better illustration of this point. This is comparing fiscal year 09, and then I have a slide on the next page, Madam Chair, for fiscal year 10. Fiscal year 09, 91% of operating and maintenance costs came from local property taxes and park users. 3.9% came from the general fund, and 5.06% came from lottery proceeds. The total was 8.96% of total park operations that came from the state. What the administration is proposing for fiscal year 10 is 91.46% from local property taxes, 3.79% would come from the general fund, and Madam Chair, 4.75% would come from natural resources for a total of 8.54, which is a 0.42 reduction, overall reduction from the state share. And finally, Madam Chair, I wanted to talk very briefly about the constitutional amendment that was passed last fall, the 3/8 cent sales tax. As you are aware, 14.25% of the proceeds from that statewide sales tax will go to state and regional parks. That 4.25% is from an anticipated dollar amount of $270 million. In other words, the 3/8 cent sales tax is anticipated to generate $270 million for parks and trails statewide. There'll be 14.25%, which is $34 million. So the question is, how will that $34 million be distributed between the state? The administration has not made any firm determination of what we will recommend, and of course the legislature, the House and the Senate, will weigh in and make a determination on that. The administration right now is looking at a dividing that $34 million. 38% of it would go to Greater Minnesota, 38% of that would go to the seven-county regional park system, and 24% would be in a, for lack of a better term, a flex pool that Greater Minnesota could tap into, the regional parks in what's known as the collar counties could tap into that 24%, and the parks within the seven-county region could tap into that as well. The governor is recommending that $6.5 million go for parks and trails in the seven-county region and 13 in fiscal year 10 and 13 in fiscal year 11. We anticipate, Madam Chair, that the Parks and Open Space Commission will be a major vehicle, though not the sole vehicle, in determining how the seven-county region's portion of the 3/8 cent sales tax will be spent in the region. And with that, Madam Chair, I would entertain any questions you or committee members may have.
What do you use out of your funding sources for restoration of land, of the natural areas of land that are in the parks?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that comes out of our capital budget. We really use our capital for land acquisition, building construction, building renovation, and land reclamation. So those four things all come out of the capital pool.
So we had a quite a discussion about this issue about restoration within parks in the Heritage Council meeting yesterday, because there were some proposals from different parks around the state who are interested in getting some dollars, some habitat dollars, to restore wetlands or prairies or other kinds of natural areas along the Mississippi River and other parts of places where there's parkland that is in a natural state but is degraded and needs to be restored to, you know, native species, et cetera. How much, do you know how much you're spending on that now and how much work is done on restoration now?
Madam Chair, I don't. Mr. Stefford may
maybe
have a sense
help
of that.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Arnie Stefford. I'm a planning analyst in the Parks Program at the Metro Council. In response to your question about how much, it's a very small amount. This last capital improvement program for 08-09, which totaled $17.5 million, roughly $100,000 was utilized, you know, from request by park agencies for prairie restoration work primarily. And the rest of it went towards either land acquisition or building, construction, or rehabilitation.
Well, we did hear that there's some pent-up demand there for restoration projects, although there was some sentiment from members of the council, some members of the council, that parks should go to the Parks and Trails Fund for any improvements to parks rather than going to the Habitat Fund. So that's something that we as legislators need to decide because, you know, in my opinion, you know, restoration is restoration, and it should be judged on its merits. But there was some concern, there was some discussion about that. So that's an issue that we'll hear more about.
Madam Chair, I think the point you're raising is an interesting one. I have personally not been party to any discussions within the administration in terms of the position the administration would take, but I understand the point that you're making, and something I think that we can and should explore.
Well, do you or Mr. Stefferud have an idea of what restoration projects are out there that are need to be done?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I meet with the regional park agencies on a weekly basis, and this last conversation regarding that was roughly $40 million in total for natural resource restoration and some habitat land acquisition. About $30 million of that $40 million would be for natural resource restoration.
Okay. All right. Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman and Senator Rummel, what did you say?
This has probably been one of my better days when I hear you say the lottery's been used like I want to use it for parks and trails. We've had to fight that constantly. So I'm glad to hear you say, Mr. Bell, that we did do that, did help parks and trails.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know who has the answer to this question or if there is an answer. Do we have a comparison of the population in outer or greater Minnesota as opposed to the seven-county area? What percent of the population lives?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, it is my – I don't have a precise number for that. I have always operated that it's close to 55-45% in that range, but I don't have a precise number for you.
Thank you.
But the visits to the park systems are very different, even though obviously a lot of people from the metro area go to state parks in greater Minnesota and vice versa. People visit back and forth. I know a lot of folks from around the state come and visit Como Park and other regional parks. But the total number of visitors in the metro parks is 33 million, you said, whereas in the state parks it's more like 8 million, so it's more dispersed. What was that, 8? Yeah. Around the state park system.
And Madam Chair, in regards to
Mr.
that,
Stafford.
That just to compare apples with apples, there's visits to state regional trails too, as well as regional parks. So if we just compare the park component, it's about 22 million. Those visits of the 33 are for regional park visits, and the rest is for regional trails.
Trails, okay, great. Thank you for that information. Just one more question. Go ahead, Senator Staxel. Senator Rummel, sorry, she's not done.
This was just a follow-up. In terms of acres or size of parks, the greater Minnesota parks compared to the metro parks, is there any sense of the difference in size of our parks? The amount of land in greater Minnesota that's parks and the
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, we have in regional park system 53,000 acres of parkland. Maybe Mr. Stefferud knows the acreage in the state park system. I do not know.
Well, Mr. Nelson is here. Maybe he can answer that. Do you want to step up and?
Madam Chair, Cortland Nelson, Director of State Parks. We have 230,000 acres in title and 267,000 acres within our state parks boundaries, which are established by legislature.
I'm just trying to get a sense of the scope that what we're talking about. So this is very helpful. Thank you.
A lot of land mass in those state parks. Senator Saxog?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stefferud, when you're talking 30 or 40 million in restoration of habitat, is that one-time money in projects or? I realize that was an estimate.
Right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, These were projects that the regional park agencies have put together in the last few weeks that would be quote-unquote shovel-ready that could be implemented in the near term. So there probably are additional costs and future restoration projects outside of that $30 million.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, and Senator Saxhog, we should ask Mr. Nelson maybe to bring an answer to that for the state parks, too, when they come in and tell us about the restoration needs and acquisition for habitat that could be aggregated like we have for the Metro Parks system. Good. That'd be really helpful information. Senator Torres Ray. And I should mention, members, we'll just take a couple more questions. We have some special guests coming in from the Minnesota Zoo in a few minutes. So there's like a snake outside the door waiting to come in, just to alert you. Now's your chance to run away if you're afraid of snakes.
Madam Chair, I have another commitment.
No, you have to stay. I don't know. Maybe they're bringing the really cute animals.
Maybe they're bringing an eagle in.
Or the eagle. I don't know who it is. So, yeah. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up on that request because I also would like to see the numbers and would like to compare the metro area and the rural areas and compare the numbers for prairie restoration and for other projects. I want to just kind of get a sense of, you know, when you say that we need about $40 million and we only have used $100,000 for prairie restoration in the metropolitan area, that's kind of an alarming number for me. But I would like to see if that is comparable to what we're doing statewide anyway. So I want to get a sense of the numbers of how we use the money for projects in parks. What is the difference between metro areas and rural?
Okay, that's a good question. Well, Mr. Nelson is here taking notes, so I'm sure he'll give us some information like that. Going back to the governor's rec on, this is for the new dollars?
Yeah, for the
constitutional dollars. How are you suggesting dividing those up among different categories, operations versus capital?
Madam Chair, we have not made any firm decisions on that question as yet. We'll clearly involve the Parks and Open Space Commission in making that determination. We will clearly involve the implementing agencies in making that decision, and of course would very much welcome and invite the perspective of the legislature as well.
So many people didn't think this would
be asked. Thank you. Any other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. We'll be obviously spending more time on the Metropolitan Parks budget in the future, but this is a very good introduction. We appreciate your being here today and taking the time with us. And we're going to ask committee members to stay for a moment, and we'll have some visitors come in just for a moment. We're not going to do the official zoo presentation, but since we're here, let's invite our visitors
in. They came
in
and gave me this great folder. Keep saying
that. Yeah. What's that?
Which door is the snake?
I'm not sure. Yeah, why don't you go peek out and see?
But
I mean, that's basically just punting it.
Yeah. I've said that to them. I guess they could have spent.
You two would like to join.
We have some zoo visitors coming.
A special tour, so we may take that.
Yeah.
Hey, he's here.
Madam Chair, Peggy Adelman, Chief Financial Officer at the Minnesota Zoo. It's Zoo Day at the Capitol, and some of you have diligently been in committee and not able to come out and see the animals, so we're going to bring some of the animals quickly in to see you.
Yay.
People either love snakes or they hate
Bickerman,
snakes.
Your favorite.
So for those who hate snakes, you may want to look away.
So cuddly.
But we have Donnie with our
boa constrictor.
Wow.
This one's about 8.5 feet long, weighs about 35 pounds, and they come from Central and South America.
Wow.
And this one, she's really, really nice. She goes to schools and libraries and other places like that with our Zoomobile program. Can I take him around to touch? If anyone has a chance to touch, I'll be around. So if you guys want a chance to touch,
okay, now's your chance to to leave if you need to.
We also have a chinchilla.
Everybody likes to touch a chinchilla.
I was going to say, we go from the sublime.
Do you like a chance?
If you don't like snakes, guaranteed.
I don't know.
This is one of our little schools, the favorites of the school groups. They're from South America. It's a wonderful touch animal, guaranteed to say all.
Yeah, about 35 pounds.
Please feel free to touch.
Yep. I just get tired real quick.
Next, next we have...
We're getting a little... Oh, my goodness. I've never seen that.
A lot of people tell me it feels like a bat.
What is that called?
Don't worry, it'll stay with me.
It's a bearded dragon.
It's a bearded dragon. Stays with me, I promise.
Now, you know, those who like snakes, you might like the tarantula.
Should the tarantula... Should the tarantula be near the snake?
And then if you really like things with legs, we have a millipede. Giant millipede.
I think I'm gonna
Oh, I like you.
Very simple.
Big awe.